From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The word unprecedented has become almost overused in the past 4 years of the Trump presidency, but now we have to say it again. Donald Trump made history yesterday as the only U.S. president to be impeached twice.
The House voted to impeach Trump for incitement of insurrection following last week's riot at the U.S. Capitol that resulted in 5 deaths. The article of impeachment will head to the Senate, but Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has indicated that a trial will not begin until after the president-elect, Joe Biden, is inaugurated next week. Let's talk more about this with NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. And Sue, why is McConnell deciding to wait until after Trump has already left office to begin the trial?
Well, the Senate has been out of session until January 19th, and technically they can't come back into session unless all senators agree to. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer tried to invoke a power given to leaders after 9/11 that would give the authority to just the top two leaders if they agreed to call them back. And McConnell said he wouldn't agree to that. There's some practicality to this decision. You know, first of all, we're just days away from inauguration. But also, the Senate still has to organize itself. Remember, Democrats just want a majority, but they have two Democrats coming into the Senate from the state of Georgia who are not technically senators yet. Their elections need to be certified, and they need to be sworn in to confirm Chuck Schumer as a majority leader. So it looks much more likely that the Senate trial is just going to consume the first several weeks of the incoming Biden administration now.
Well, I mean, with that in mind, then, I mean, why go through the impeachment process for a president who by then will already be out of office? I mean, what's the opposing argument?
Yeah, I think we're going to hear a lot about this from Republicans in the Senate as to defending why they're not going to vote to convict. Tom Cotton, who's a Republican from Arkansas, already said he did not believe that Congress had the power to vote to convict a president when he was no longer out of office. There is going to be some debate over whether that is even legitimate, although there is some precedent for impeachments moving forward when someone is no longer in public office, although not with a president. You know, I think Democrats and clearly 10 Republicans in the House who voted with them yesterday think there's something bigger at stake here, that they need to set a precedent, not just for to send a message for what happened this week, but a message to all future presidents that if they engage in conduct as to what President Trump did in undermining the integrity of the election and encouraging an incitement of rioters to storm the Capitol, if anything of that behavior ever happens again, it will be considered an impeachable offense. It's more of a warning shot to future presidents as well as a punishment to the president. One.
Yeah, and it was striking that Mitch McConnell did not make that argument. You mentioned that it would not be constitutional to try him after he's left office. He's saying the trial will go on after he leaves office. So you mentioned the 10 Republicans who supported this impeachment yesterday. Among them was Liz Cheney of Wyoming. She's the third ranking Republican in the House. What does that signal about the future of this party? And are we going to see this rift widen?
Well, we don't know yet, but we do know that the House Freedom Caucus, which is a group of the sort of the hard right in the House, is trying to throw her out from her leadership job. They say that she shouldn't be a part of the leadership because she voted for impeachment. Some of her defenders push back on this and say, look, leadership didn't whip this vote. They told members it was a vote of conscience. And you can't tell someone it's a vote of conscience and then punish them for voting their conscience. But if they do force this vote, if they do force a referendum on Cheney in the House, I think it will be a good indicator of which way the future of the party is going. If they successfully manage to oust her, the only woman at the leadership table, from that job, I think it will cement Trump's hold on the party, at least for the short term. But if she's able to hold on, I think it will tell us that there are more Republicans, at least in private, who are willing to move on from this president, because this vote would be cast in secret ballot. Members wouldn't have to tie their names to it. So it's something that we're going to be watching closely in the weeks ahead, if they actually force it and what the result will be and what it might tell us about where this party's going.
Do we know then in advance where Republican senators are leaning?
Well, the most fascinating question is, where is Mitch McConnell? Because there was a New York Times report this week citing anonymous sources saying that he supported impeachment, that he thought the president had committed impeachable offenses. And that cracked the door open to this idea that Mitch McConnell, of all people, could be a vote to convict. Now, his office has not commented on that, but they have not denied what the New York Times reported. You know, it would still take a lot, right? Even if you can presume for a second that all 50 Senate Democrats, and we don't know that for certain, would vote to convict, they would need 17 Republicans to join them. I mean, that's just would require a tremendous break from the president here. The thing we don't know, and one thing we're going to be watching really closely in the weeks ahead, is who does the president tap to defend him, and what is the defense of him that they make on the floor? You know, the president has not personally really defended himself or his actions, and that defense is going to play a major role in how Senate Republicans make up their mind. I do think that Democrats are expecting more Republicans to support this impeachment than they did the last time when it was just one senator, Mitt Romney.
All right. NPR's Susan Davis. Sue, thanks.
You're welcome.
The FBI is warning that last week's deadly breach of the U.S. Capitol building could be a significant driver of violence ahead of next week's inauguration. And state Capitol buildings are now on alert because the federal government says they're likely targets of domestic violent extremists. Michael German is a former FBI agent who focused on domestic terrorism. He's now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and he joins us on Skype. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
20,000 armed members of the National Guard will be at the Capitol for the inauguration next week. 8-foot fencing has already been put up around the building. Is that enough to keep it safe?
A big part of the problem is that law enforcement has turned its gaze away from these groups for so long that I think they don't really have a very good understanding of what is going on. You know, they seem to think that this assault on the Capitol is a standalone act, and rather than recognizing that they have, that law enforcement has been allowing far right militants to engage in violence at rallies across the country for the last 4 years.
Our colleague Tanya Mosley spoke with Congressman Jim Clyburn today, who said it seemed to him that the rioters had inside information about where his unmarked office was and that they had knowledge about where he could be found. There's reporting that some of the extremists may have been given tours of the building by lawmakers the day before the riot, and we know a number of police officers are under investigation for potentially sympathizing with people in the mob. Are you seeing anything that tells you that this could be more organized than it first appeared?
So again, what shocks me is the failure to recognize this has been a pattern of activity over several years, right? Far-right militants just 2 weeks before attacked the Oregon State Legislature and breached the doors there, attacking law enforcement, attacking journalists. There was a shooting at a rally at the Washington State Legislature. We've seen the armed incursions of state legislatures across the country. This is a problem that has been allowed to fester. And
why? Why'd they miss it?
You know, white supremacy and far-right militancy is different. You know, a lot of researchers will try to talk about terrorist groups like they're all the same. And I even saw one researcher suggest, you know, that this would have been a lot worse if ISIS or Al-Qaeda had mingled in with the crowd assaulting the Capitol, where, no, this group had people who were trained by the U.S. military. They had people who carry badges, who have the authority of the law. If the FBI thought any law enforcement officer in the country was an ISIS sympathizer, they'd react very differently. They know there are a lot of white supremacist sympathizers and sympathizers of these far-right militant groups, but they don't react. They don't have any national strategy to address that issue. So this is deeply ingrained, right? If you walk through the Capitol, you won't see any ISIS flags or Al-Qaeda flags in any members' offices, but you'll see Confederate flags.
Well, the point you just made brings us to the president. Here he is in a video message last night decrying the mob violence that he's accused of inciting.
I have been briefed by the U.S. Secret Service on the potential threats. Every American deserves to have their voice heard in a respectful and peaceful way. That is your First Amendment right. But I cannot emphasize that there must be no violence, no lawbreaking, and no vandalism of any kind.
So the president did not mention his false claims of election fraud in that video, but he also didn't say that it was a valid election. Do you think he did enough to call off his supporters with that statement?
I don't think it's enough, and I think it's too late anyway. The people who, number one, who are convinced that the election was stolen aren't going to change their mind no matter what Donald Trump says today. I don't have a Parler account. I don't follow 8chan or 4chan. And I was hearing what they were planning. I don't know how law enforcement is claiming they weren't. They were planning this in public.
Well, meanwhile, the government now is threatening that it's going to get worse. This new bulletin yesterday said that domestic violent extremists citing partisan political grievances, will pose the greatest domestic terrorism threat in 2021. It also says that journalists will be targeted. What's the threat look like going forward, far beyond January 20th?
You know, I think we have to be somewhat careful. It's really easy to frighten the public and, you know, the FBI and some people at the Justice Department and former FBI and Justice Department people are trying to use this to gain more authority. So I think we need to keep it in perspective. These groups have been the most deadly domestic threat for years. There are many communities of color and others that have been subjected to the violence that these groups mete out on a regular basis, and law enforcement hasn't been addressing it.
Michael German, former FBI special agent, now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Today, China announced its first COVID-19 death in 8 months. That news comes the same day a team from the World Health Organization arrived in Wuhan to investigate the origins of the pandemic. You may remember the first cases of the coronavirus were reported from that city in December 2019. The cluster emerged at a wet market where wild animals are sold along with meat, produce, and other items. I spoke earlier with Dr. Peter Ben-Mbarak. He's a scientist on the team. He was on a cell phone from Singapore, where he was in quarantine before heading to Wuhan. And I asked him what his team will try to accomplish there.
The goal of this mission is to help improve our understanding of the origin of the virus. We all know that the virus jumped out from its natural environment in bat population, and then we have the detection of the first cases in Wuhan. But in between, we don't know. We don't know what happened, and that's what we want to try to get a better understanding of.
How important is it to be there in person rather than doing this research remotely?
It's important to be there because being there enables face-to-face contact with Chinese researchers and counterparts. It also enables us to visit different sites. Visiting the market would give us a good idea of the dynamic within that market. We have done that for months now to have virtual meetings and over the internet, but it doesn't replace face-to-face interaction in smaller groups and rejoining in larger groups. So it's important to have that physical dynamic in a face-to-face environment.
So I hear you referring to the wet market where some of the early cases first appeared. You say you'll be visiting there. I mean, this was a place where the whole world had its eye on this market when the outbreak first started a year ago. When you get there, what will you do? What questions will you try to answer?
The market has been closed since last year. However, the records of what came in and out of that market do still exist and have a lot of value in terms of understanding, identifying animals that were brought to that market, understanding what goods were brought into that market, where they went out afterwards. This was a wholesale market, mind you, so it was also serving a number of other markets in the city, and understanding what the people who were working there, where did they come from, did they have any travel history to particular places that could give us some clues of where the some of them could have brought the disease from outside to the market. So it has still a lot of value even a year after.
You know, there have been questions about whether China would even let you and your team into the country. The government has been floating the idea that the outbreak started in a different country. Do you think that Beijing can be trusted to give you access to what you need to do your job?
Yes, I mean, we are on our way to the to Wuhan now, so, and we have had many meetings with Chinese experts over the past few months. So there is a keen interest to participate and support these different studies. But of course, and understandably, they and others are also interested to ensure that other avenues and other studies are also conducted. If the initial data and results of studies indicate that there is a value in looking elsewhere, we would, of course, also do that. But as always in these type of investigations, we start where the first cases were detected, and that was in Wuhan in December 2019. And we go from there and we follow what the science and the studies tell us. And that approach has also been agreed and supported by China.
So explain that a little bit more, if you could. Are you going in assuming that the pandemic started in Wuhan, or how will you be able to even confirm that? And frankly, why does it matter?
We know that the first cases detected were detected in Wuhan in December 19. It does mean that these were the first cases. And remember that the cases detected were only severe cases. We did not know at that time that there was a lot of mild cases, a lot of asymptomatic cases. And trying to identify these will be extremely interesting as well, because they may be the ones holding the clue to the where the first cases originated from, and not the severe cases that we know of. So it's also important to try to find all the cases and other cases and the ones that were detected in December. Because it's not because the first cases were detected in Wuhan that the whole thing started in Wuhan. It could easily have started somewhere else in another province, a few hundred kilometers away or even further away. It's a starting point for the work, but it's not the starting point necessarily of the pandemic.
Peter Benembarek is a World Health Organization scientist joining us on a cell phone in Singapore and part of a team who headed to Wuhan, China to investigate the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Benembarek, thanks for making time for us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And we spoke yesterday. Dr. Benembarek has now arrived in Wuhan. He'll quarantine for 2 weeks before he and the rest of his team can start their work.
And back in the U.S., the spread of COVID-19 has accelerated in Mesa County, Colorado, in recent months. But the pandemic's devastating economic effect arrived much earlier, back in the spring, when people suddenly faced lockdowns, job losses, and shortages at the grocery store. That sparked a grassroots movement to help. And as Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg reports, today the relief effort is bigger than ever.
Tyson Ellis is carefully scanning long tables, heaped with food and other essentials. Tomatoes, bread, salsa, diapers.
Mac and cheese.
Not too cook friendly right now.
All right, so we're not cooking. That's all right.
Yeah.
Volunteer Sarah Rogers then gestures toward a large pile of candy and snacks.
So you want some?
Oh, yeah.
A little bit of everything? Do you like the cheese crackers?
Oh, yeah. They're my downfall.
It's Tuesday, also known here as Distribution Day, for the group Grand Junction Mutual Aid. Ellis says he always tries to make it.
I actually look forward to watching people get a little bit of happiness and hope, as much as getting the food is nice.
Ellis, who right now lives in a tent, is one of about 100 people who will walk through the food line today. Grand Junction Mutual Aid also delivers food boxes and estimates it feeds about 500 families a week. And food assistance is just one arm of this organization, a group that was born in mid-March after founder Jacob Richards emerged from a wilderness trip teaching a bunch of school kids.
Came back and it was a different world.
One where toilet paper and hand sanitizer were impossible to find, and cheap, reliable food staples like pasta were scarce. Richards used to be a community activist. He gave it up years ago. But he could still see that many people in Grand Junction needed a way to support one another and cut through their own panic.
As soon as people are taking action and have some agency, everything's a little less scary.
So Richards launched the Grand Junction Mutual Aid Facebook group.
Within a couple hours, I realized we were on to something, and within 3 days, we had 7,000 members.
Today, there are twice as many members. They make requests on the page for help, like firewood or jackets for their kids, and responses often pour in. The group has also grown a network of volunteers who work with seniors, people who don't have housing, and others. Richard says that early in the pandemic, volunteers made 50,000 masks to donate to local healthcare workers.
You know, I think mutual aid really takes that idea of like the marketing slogan you see way too much nowadays of we're all in it together, and we make that real.
We just got a whole bunch donated yesterday.
And it's most visible at the Tuesday distribution event at Grand Junction's Unitarian Universalist Church. Starting in the morning, people can both drop off donations and take what they need. Due to COVID-19, only a few recipients are allowed in the building at a time, and a line stretches out into the parking lot. As Megan Cruikshank waits her turn, she starts to cry.
It's my first time struggling like this.
She was a photographer for a local studio before she lost her job in the pandemic. She still has a place to live, but doesn't know for how long. Cruikshank tells me there's some comfort being here, alongside others also facing hard times.
It sounds so terrible to say that, because I don't want anyone to be in a bad situation, but it helps to know that I'm not in this situation by myself.
By showing up today, Cruikshank is now part of a community where there's not much separation between those who give and those who receive. Many volunteers also take donated food home to their families, and some have experienced homelessness, including Cindy Stewart. But she says she never had anything like this group back then.
Oh, it would have been the world to me.
So Stewart volunteers as much as she can now. Today, wearing her sock monkey hat over her long gray hair, she'll make deliveries to people in a big van someone donated to her. Stewart loves seeing how happy it can make someone to receive a box of food and a bit of connection.
So it's a blessing to us all, you know, just people helping people.
With no forms to fill out to get that help, no interviews needed.
Only requirement is if you're hungry, let us know, you know, and we'll try to get you some food.
Something to count on when so much remains uncertain. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
A three grows in Brooklyn. That's the headline on the sports page of today's New York Post. It's a riff on the famous 1943 novel, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. The reference is to yesterday's blockbuster trade in basketball. NBA star James Harden will be joining Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving as members of the Brooklyn Nets. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, what do you think? The Houston Rockets sent a superstar to the Nets.
Yeah, and the Nets had a pretty substantial forest to begin with because Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, two blockbuster players, represented what was probably the best or second best team in the East. But what was going on in Houston was James Harden was not happy, and he was making his unhappiness known. He was making his unhappiness felt. He even hired, which is a thing now, outside consultants to try to get him a trade. This didn't necessarily mean here's how you complain your way out of Houston, but that was the practical effect. So this blockbuster trade goes down, and what it means is that other than the LA Lakers, I'd say Brooklyn has the best lineup. We'll see how they gel. They're not a good defensive team, but it's probable that they could score on almost all their possessions, and the only choice will be, shall it be a two or a three? So that's going to represent a huge headache. There are two other teams, the Cavaliers, the Pacers. So many other teams were involved in this trade. I would also say that Houston, who in James Harden had a distressed asset, and everyone knew they were sellers, which isn't a great position to be in, did great. They got so many picks back from Brooklyn. They got the maximum, more than anyone thought that they could get for their disgruntled superstar.
If you score on every possession, what does that mean? You make like 350 points or something like that? That'd be hard to beat.
Yeah, it's about three. Well, it depends. Again, twos and threes. Do you get fouled on the three? There's a lot of considerations.
Yeah. Anyways, it comes while the NBA is dealing with a pretty significant COVID-19 problem. Three games were postponed last night. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, just that the Heat had a COVID outbreak, the Sixers, and sometimes it's not a COVID outbreak, it's one positive test, but then a number of other players have to quarantine. In the beginning of the season, the Houston Rockets, the team we were talking about, had to sit out a game because they were playing the Oklahoma City Thunder, and a combination of players sitting out with COVID and injuries meant that there were seven players you need to have more than that to play the game. So, you know, and we've said it before, we'll say it again, NBA microcosm of what's going on. There is no bubble. This means that teams are going to miss games. The NBA only actually released half its schedule in the beginning of the year, a concession to the fact that they'd have to be flexible.
Mike, what about hockey? The NHL started this week, and the commissioner, Gary Bettman, says the league is going to lose more than $1 billion this year because of the pandemic shortened 56-game schedule. That is a lot of money. What's going on?
It is. And it's different from some of the other leagues, which will lose money. But to take the NBA, for instance, they would lose less or did lose less money by playing than they would have by not playing. I think what Bettman is saying, and there's reason to think that it's accurate, is that the NHL would actually have lost less money or would have been a better business proposition just to not have a season this year. And a lot of that is because the basketball, baseball, football, they rely on a lot of money from their TV contracts. The NHL doesn't have that.
Yep. Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
COVID-19 is unrelenting in Arizona. 182 deaths reported today and more than 7,300 new cases. The state has started vaccinating people at the Arizona Cardinals football stadium. The arena seats more than 63,000 fans, and to date, enough people have tested positive in Arizona to fill it 10 times over. Hospitals are nearing capacity, and doctors are bracing for more infections in the coming weeks. Among them is Dr. Matthew G. Hines, who also serves on the Board of Supervisors in Pima County. He joins me now from Tucson. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Hines, I mean, these numbers we're seeing out of Arizona are staggering. How are you handling them, and has the surge changed the way you practice as a physician?
You know, it actually has. And like all other healthcare workers, we run toward problems, and we're all still doing that. But, you know, it is certainly straining hospital capacity, as you mentioned. And, you know, we're a lot of things are becoming suboptimal. You know, it's getting close to the point where we're going to have to be looking at some significant rationing of care and care options, as I think they're seeing in LA County.
Well, one of the things that is suboptimal in the eyes of many is that Arizona, like many places, has had a relatively slow vaccine rollout. And this is despite some of the efforts we just mentioned, like converting a stadium into a vaccine center. So why do you think that's the case? I mean, is it a systemic problem, or are people hesitating to get the vaccine?
You know, I think there's multiple factors. I think nationwide we're seeing a much slower rollout than we were hoping for. I think that has to do a lot with supply. Here in Pima County and in southern Arizona, we're doing we're doing the best in terms of our rollout, but it's still slower than I would want, and we're working on that. But it is a combination of getting enough of the vaccine supply into the various sites where we're distributing and injecting folks. So I know that as we move into the 75 and 65-year-old plus categories, that's hundreds of thousands of people in Pima County, and you know we have 80,000 vaccines. So we hope that the supply
this is part of that
will catch up.
Yeah, this is part of that transition into phase 1B. I understand, though, Dr. Hines, I have to ask you that you got your own COVID-19 vaccine this morning. So I got to ask, how did that go for you? How are you feeling?
I did. And you know, it's a tremendous relief. It felt like any other vaccine, a flu shot. I was there with multiple folks who were newly eligible in that 1B category, several elderly couples, and you know, a couple other healthcare workers like myself. And it is definitely relieving to get that. And it was a Moderna vaccine. So I have, you know, another 4 weeks, I will get the second dose. And I wanted to do that and let people know that I'm doing it because I trust science and it's This is how we're going to get out of this, but we have a few months. They're going to be pretty difficult, especially in Arizona ahead of us, I think.
Yeah, and one of the things to watch, I think, is whether your state will move to a statewide mask mandate, which is not the case right now. That's Dr. Matthew Hines. He's a member of the Board of Supervisors in Pima County, Arizona. He joined us from Tucson. Dr. Hines, thank you.
Thank you.
You have a prepaid call. This call is from
Chris,
an inmate at Monroe Correctional Complex.
We're going to take a minute now to go inside a prison to get a different perspective on the pandemic. Christopher Blackwell is a prisoner at the Monroe Correctional Complex in Washington State. He recently wrote an editorial in the Washington Post calling for prisoners to get vaccinated early, and some states have started doing that. Blackwell is serving a 45-year sentence for robbery and murder, and right now he's on COVID lockdown, so he had to call us during a one-hour break outside his cell. I asked him what conditions were like inside Monroe.
So recently we had an extreme outbreak in our unit due to medical staff not following protocol, and a prisoner was showing some symptoms on the 23rd of December, and they had brought him out, tested him with two tests, and then brought him back to the unit. He had still symptoms and was positive. They didn't know because the first test that they had taken was a rapid test and it came back negative. On Christmas Day, his test that went to the lab came back and he was positive for COVID, and he had interacted with most of our unit. Today, our unit, which holds roughly around 170 people, there's 13 of us left on the unit who have not tested positive. And the rest of the unit has been taken off to medical isolation, which is solitary confinement, or the gym, which has been turned into a housing for prisoners who have tested positive that were asymptomatic. And it's housing probably close to around 100 prisoners, if not more. My unit is not the only one that suffered. The unit next to ours, D unit, also suffered, and they're down to about 70 prisoners. So they have about 100 of their prisoners taken out of their side. So it's been quite a few weeks here. Quite a Christmas.
I'm sure. How are you able to get that information, considering you're in a prison, and I'm sure you're not able to move around quite as much as you would otherwise, and it's probably hard to, you know, have conversations with folks, or maybe I'm wrong.
So it's fair to say that some staff have been really open and honest, because they also feel that their life has been put in danger, I would assume. From the circumstances of medical not following the procedure that's been laid out by the CDC, where they would take any prisoner showing any symptoms, they would be held for 14 days and they would have to receive a double negative test before they would be put back in population around guards and prisoners. So quite a few guards have been pretty open and honest about their frustration around it too.
So what's the prison doing to make sure that you're socially distanced or wearing masks or doing anything to prevent this infection from spreading?
So you can't social distance in a prison.
Exactly.
It's completely virtually impossible. So the prison has, you know, I will say that, for one, I don't envy anyone in a leadership position that has had to take on this task, because they are not trained, they are not ready, they are not equipped. What has happened is recently they have started to step up measures with things like masks and stuff. We honestly were very poorly given medical equipment, given masks. The whole thing just wasn't handled in a manner where anybody was prepared or they were educated enough to do it. The prisons can.
But you have masks now?
People. We do have masks now since the Washington Post article on a regular basis.
I see. Well, at the start of the pandemic, many governors around the country, including in Washington where you are, they were releasing nonviolent inmates or people whose sentences were about to end. That was the idea at the time, was to reduce crowding. Have you seen that, and has it helped at all with the spread of COVID in prisons?
There was mostly people that were going home very, very soon anyway, so I don't know how effective it was, since then the prisons refilled out pretty close to what it was, so it didn't really have a large effect. There's still people that were doubled up on the fourth tier in my unit in a 6x10 cell, and there's two prisoners stuck in there, impossible to social distance. I mean, our prison looks pretty crowded to me.
Yeah. You wrote an editorial in the Washington Post, which we've referred to here, calling for prisoners to be among the first to get a vaccine. Have you gotten a vaccine yet? And what's your argument for why you should, if you haven't?
No one in my prison has gotten a vaccine yet. I think it's important because we are in an area where we can't social distance. Guards have to come in from the outside. And yeah, granted, all of us are here for a reason, and some of us have caused grievous harm on individuals in the community, myself included, but that does not mean that anybody's sentenced to die. That doesn't mean anybody should go through extreme suffering. They've been sentenced to have a loss of liberties, and that's all that should come with the sentence.
Right, because you know there are going to be people who hear this shouting at the radio saying, no way, this guy's a convicted murderer. He doesn't deserve a shot before me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand. I understand that there's frustration and people feel that way. And it is on me to be accountable for the harm I caused almost 20 years ago in my community. But it still doesn't differ or change the fact that we weren't sentenced to die here.
Christopher Blackwell, a prisoner at Monroe Correctional Complex in Washington State, talking about the conditions with COVID-19 there inside. Christopher, thank you so much.
Yeah.
We reached out to the prison to get more information. A spokesman declined to answer our questions.
Food insecurity is growing in the U.S. as COVID-19 continues to ravage public health and the economy. Federal food assistance programs such as SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, have evolved during the pandemic to meet some of the increased need, but advocates say there's still a long way to go to ensure equity in access. Amy Yarrow is executive director of the Gretchen Swanson Center for Nutrition, a nonprofit research center in Omaha, Nebraska. She's well-versed in federal food assistance programs. Amy, welcome.
Thanks. I appreciate being here.
Well, could you start by just giving us a quick reminder of what exactly SNAP entails? You know, what kind of food people can use it to buy and who it's meant for?
Sure. As you mentioned, SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So formerly known as food stamps, and it's really for very low-income people. So to give you an idea, the average allotment last year was $136 per month for individuals and $267 for households, which really equates to about $4.50 per day for individuals and $8.75 per day for households. So it's to supplement and provide so that they SNAP households are able to have food on the table.
And we know that demand for SNAP has only increased during the pandemic, maybe because people have been laid off, lost jobs, or experiencing some other type of economic hardships during the pandemic. So what sorts of changes have been made during this pandemic period to improve SNAP access?
Sure, there's been a lot. So one big thing that has happened is SNAP Online. And so SNAP Online is technically still a pilot, and it's really important because it becomes an equity issue. So, you know, SNAP participants should be able to have a safe way in order to order groceries online for delivery or pickup, just like everyone else. And maybe even more so, since low-income groups are disproportionately bearing the brunt of COVID and have worse outcomes. And also, SNAP participants in many cases are working multiple jobs, and so they even have a hard time getting to the grocery store in the first place.
And we know some folks have been using online grocery shopping as a convenience during the pandemic, either delivery or curbside pickup, but that's not always an option for folks using SNAP. It's not at all an option for folks using WIC. That's the Women, Infants, and Children program for children who are 0 to 5. And so I'm wondering, why is that so problematic in your view, Amy?
Well, just to give you an idea, earlier in 2020, SNAP Online was only fully operational in 9 states. And by the end of 2020, USDA was able to pivot with the pandemic and move light speed ahead. And now it's in 47 states. So just to show, like, again, how much the demand was. And, you know, the SNAP Online should be an option for everyone. But unfortunately, not everyone necessarily feels that way. And even if grocery stores do the small ones, then there's this startup cost. There's a long application and testing process required to onboard. And the end of the line, which are the SNAP participants themselves, they don't even necessarily realize that they're SNAP Online in their state or even how to navigate the complicated scrambled PIN process for their SNAP cards. So really, education on how to navigate online SNAP is necessary.
So that gives us a sense of why some of the challenges of getting up. I'll just add one point of clarification, which is that you can't use your SNAP benefits for the delivery fee itself. You can use it to buy the groceries, but then you would have to pick up the tab for the delivery. And so that may sort of assuage some of the concerns from folks who don't want to spend taxpayer dollars in that way. In the moments that we have left, Amy, I'm curious then, you know, on the federal level with the USDA overseeing the SNAP program, although it is administered at the states, I'm curious what you hope for under a new administration in terms of improving equity in food assistance programs like SNAP?
So with a new administration, I think that we have an opportunity. Vilsack, who's the incoming secretary, has experience working in the Obama administration. And there has been this momentum that's been built for new SNAP online ordering and redemption systems. So SNAP is authorized under the Farm Bill, and it's really the largest federal food assistance program, and it's also the largest part of the Farm Bill itself. So really, now more than ever, there's an opportunity for USDA and this new administration to pivot and refocus even further on food insecurity and health equity and alleviate it even more during COVID.
And as you point out, even with SNAP access online expanding to 47 states, that doesn't necessarily mean that every participating retailer is part of the program, even if it is in their state. So there's still work to be done. Amy Yarrow is executive director of the Gretchen Swanson Center for Nutrition, a nonprofit research center in Omaha, Nebraska. Amy, thank you.
Thank you, Callum.
And also this note, the latest stimulus package from Congress includes a 15% bump in SNAP benefits over the next 6 months. That applies to the roughly 43 million Americans who currently use SNAP. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.